If I were to distill the four ingredients of writing and the four reasons people come for writing coaching, it starts like this: memory, imagination, observation, questions about the world and ourselves in it. We come to the blank page to work stuff out, and in doing so, to connect. I want this podcast to honour and explore that with a different writer, sometimes more than one writer, and sometimes more than one genre, each episode. We'll be talking about the memory, the observation, the imagination that joins the bits together, or the questions about the world and ourselves that led those writers to go on those journeys. At the end of that discussion, there'll be a writing exercise and a theme or question that is relevant to that, that says, now you lead. It's a place to exercise your memory, your imagination, and your sense of your right to those things. Just like the physical gym, if you turn up once a year, then the differences don't happen quite as quickly. But if you bring in good writing habits every day, at least every week, regularly in your life, then you do see the difference. And the writing confidence doesn't feel like confidence. It feels like focus. It feels like interest. It feels like curiosity. I'm Rachel Knightley. Welcome to the Writer's Gym. One of the basic realities of my childhood was the guitar. My mother is a guitarist. She used to play in restaurants. One of my earliest memories of the guitar are when she and I came back to England from California, where I was born, and she had a guitar tutor called Richard Wright. He was in a band called Latin Quarter. And for me as a kid, that was perfectly normal. You went to your friend Rachel and Bridget's house, and your mum went upstairs to have her guitar lesson, and you played and did whatever small children did at that point. And then the adults would come back and you'd talk to them. And the music of Latin Quarter was absolutely basic to me growing up. And I think it's the reason why memoir for me and fiction for me blend so beautifully, and why I never did that. Is it all right? Is it all right to use everything and mix them and learn to do that? Because the work of Mike Jones in Latin Quarter, the songs that are political and personal, it's all absolutely the same thing. And his passions and his beliefs, politically and personally, taught me a huge amount about writing.
Hello, Mike. Thanks so much for coming to talk to me. This is really lovely. Has it been a while since you were interviewed or asked about things like this?
That's a good question. Do you know about that Latin Quarter podcast? Well, I can send you a link to it. I mean,
Ooh, yes.
That's six episodes, and I didn't take part in it. I mean, I've got very mixed feelings about Latin Quarter these days. I probably haven't talked about Latin Quarter for a long time. I can't remember the last time it would have been, you know? Mm. I'm intrigued. I mean, what's your particular interest in...
Okay, I turned up in England in 1980. Oh, gosh. I was two, so 1984, 85. And my mum's a classical guitarist, and she found Richard Wright as her teacher. So...
Oh, yeah.
My sort of early memories of music really involve my mum and her friends and the things that she did. So when she had a guitar lesson at Richard's house, I was brought along and I played with his daughters, with the other Rachel and Bridget.
We were,
you know, Bridget was a baby, we were tiny. So I was aware of Latin Quarter, and the whole thing felt very... like it was mine, because my friends wouldn't know about it. So it was in a place in my head that a lot of the music I was exposed to wasn't it. I felt like it operated on some sort of more personal level. And I do remember seeing the CDs at a friend's house several years later, and there was a certain feeling of, that's mine. Like, what's that? How dare you? That's mine. What's that doing there? It was that. And I think for me, although I knew I wanted to write stories, the idea that writing music was also writing, that you could in any way put it in the same category of the universe didn't really occur to me then. And if I'm honest, I think I still feel like that, because I was very lazy with music as a child, and I'm now a beginner guitarist and I'm doing things, but it was very much outside my comfort zone. So I think for me, there was something quite magical and different about it when it was songs rather than prose or poetry or anything else, which, you know, rationally makes no sense whatsoever, because lyrics are absolutely poetry. And, you know, it wasn't a rational thing. It was just that was how it felt at the time. And that was how it came to happen. I did go and sit with Rachel at a recording session once, and it was when Blair Cunningham was drumming, and that would have been, I mean, you'll probably know better than me, but this was all a very long time ago now.
That would be in the 90s sometime, wouldn't it? Yeah.
It was definitely sometime in the 90s, and I hadn't left school, so I'm guessing pre-98. But that was my introduction.
Yeah, that could have been either the Bringing Rosa Home album, probably, because they recorded Long Pig and Bringing Rosa Home. They recorded both of those in Richard's house, I think. And I was quite distanced from it then, not so much in terms of my commitment as a writer, but my life was turned upside down when we lost our record deal. I mean, absolutely turned upside down.
Can you hear, when you're talking, there's a sort of noise. Is that happening for you?
No, I think it's your end. I haven't got anything here.
Oh, that's a shame.
Although,
okay.
One of my students said the other day, asked me yesterday, did I have a dog? Because they could hear a dog breathing. I said, well, no, I'm not a dog. That was somewhere else, mind you, I must say. So have you still got it? Have you still got the buzz?
Yeah, it's going, but, oh, it stopped.
Oh, good.
And it starts when you talk. Oh, dear. Okay.
When Latin Quarter lost its record deal, it was an enormous personal watershed for me. And it's over 30 years ago now. But it completely changed the course of my life. And in a way, I'm still in flight. I'm going to say flight. I'm not exaggerating. I was living in North Wales at the time, and we'd been to Los Angeles and made the third album, Swimming Against the Stream. And Steve and I had gone off and done promotion for it. So we'd been to Sweden. Can't remember where else we'd been. And I was expecting then the next album, the cycle, to be initiated. So that means I get a certain percentage of the publishing advance and a certain percentage of the recording advance. And that, by that time, would have come to a lot of money. It would have been the fourth album. And one of the great ironies of Latin Quarter is that my best friend was our manager, became our manager. So this is somebody I'd known since I was 7 years old, you know. So the telephone goes and I pick it up, and he gives me the news that RCA have dropped us. So no money is going to come in. And at that time, I'd done all the things that are most expensive in life. I was then with my former partner. We bought a house, we had a baby, she bought a new car, and we'd been on holiday to Italy, and I'd maxed out my credit cards. So I had absolutely no money, and I was expecting a large amount of money to come in. So, and I lived in a very small town because she'd got a job had a job in the health service, and had moved. We moved from Liverpool. I'm in Liverpool now, but we'd moved. So I went to the shop, as I would do every morning, and I bought a pint of milk and a loaf of bread and a newspaper. And I handed over what was then my last £5 note. It was suddenly my last £5 note. So of course I got a handful of change, and I was in a state of absolute shock. It was the news, but I mean, the brute reality of that news was I was down to, I don't know how much, you know, let's say £3.50. And I looked at it and I thought, my God, that's all the money I've got in the world. And I put it in my pocket. And then I looked at the newspaper, at my horoscope, to see whether the day would get any better. You know, it took 10 years from that day for me to get the job I have now. 10 years. So it was a decade of complete crisis. And everything in my life changed as a result of that moment. So when I listened to the podcast, and, you know, and they're full of praise for me. I mean, Richard especially is an enormous fan of mine, but so are the others, you know. And I wasn't exactly angry about them, as there was anger in there. It wasn't exactly anger. It was, this has nothing to do with my life. And yet it had everything to do with my life because I put absolutely everything into what I wrote. I wasn't a casual writer. I set my, you know, I really committed to the writing. And you know, they're not even ironies. There's something more toxic than an irony. But we were signed by German RCA, and then we just did a fill-in album for them, which did nothing, and we got dropped by them. And then we were signed by a German independent label, and we made the album Long Pig. And in many ways, that's the best writing I ever did. I was really, really proud of everything I'd written on that album. And we went to Germany to promote it, and the band went. But now, do you know, I can't remember, maybe Blake Cunningham was in that band. And we met Vera Branders, it was her record label. And I thought, right, great, we're just about to start again. Obviously, we'd slid down, but I mean, you know, we'd still done a few snakes, but we're still in the game. And we go to her office, and she said, well, she said, it's sold 10,000, and that's it. You know, it's not big enough to be a success, not small enough. And I thought, my God, this is already over. You know, this hasn't even been... I felt we were just beginning again with a new lineup and a new album. And for that person, it was already over. And the shocks, I mean, I teach this now, and I've been teaching this for a long time. And one of the things I try to prepare students for, but you can't really, is just the emotional gravity of being involved in any kind of creative, I hate to say business, creative endeavor. Let's sanitize it and call it an endeavor rather than a business. But the emotional demands, my God, I find them enormous. You can hear, you know, even now speaking to you, it isn't because I haven't spoken about this for a long time. I speak about this a lot, quite honestly, I suppose, with, you know, my wife and with other people. And that's how I experience it, as an enormous emotional burden and an experience. And one that I've never really come to terms with. And I've been working in this job a long, I mean, it'll be my 25th year next year, at which point I'll retire. And I enjoy it. And, you know, I mean, so many amazing things have happened to me the last 5 or 6 years. I've got this enormous Beatles connection now, which I never expected to have, you know. But I still feel in a state of shock from Latin Quarter, you know. So there you go.
There is so many directions I could go in right now. In terms of my coaches and my university students, exploring the political and the personal motivation for writing a song, I'd love to ask you how similar the approach, the drive is, and how that works for you.
One of the things I do at the moment is I teach on a Beatles MA. It's called Beatles Heritage and Industry. So what I'm looking at is the fact that Liverpool has struggled to come to terms with the fact that the Beatles came from Liverpool. So now Liverpool kind of embraces the Beatles, but at one time they were really resistant to the Beatles. But it's not just that, it's that the way I've approached it is to say there were two breakups. Liverpool broke up as an important, wealthy port from, I would say, the beginning of the First World War onwards. Some people would date it from the end of the Second World War, but nonetheless, this was the second city of empire. There were more millionaires in Liverpool in the 1790s than there were in London. And, you know, the architecture of Liverpool, I mean, the Luftwaffe did for a lot of it. But, I mean, this is an incredibly impressive city that has fallen in on itself. Half the population is gone. It's gone down from 800,000 to 400,000. And it's, you know, the wealthiest people in Liverpool are footballers, solicitors and drug dealers. I'm part of a middle class, but I mean, everybody else is really, really, you know. Therefore, it's so consumed with its own self-identity and image and its breakup and the enormity of it, that why the hell would it ever commemorate the Beatles? So it's been a 50-year process, 50-year process to get Liverpool. Because what I say to the students is, look, We can't go into the past. We can't access the past. All we can do is tell stories about it.
Something that just really strikes me about your answer to that question, when I was saying personal or political, your personality and your personal history means that those two are very deeply...
Inseparable. They're inseparable. I think about all my choices. actually, and I weigh them and I try to balance them. And is this a right decision or a wrong decision? And it's always within a political frame of reference. You have to
And the
make a difference.
right to your own voice is something that, when teaching memoir, but actually when teaching everything else as well, is something that I try to prioritize, because we were looking at Model Son the other day, and the thing that a lot of the exercises that I do are around is noticing when one is censoring oneself, as in, oh, I can't possibly say that, it would hurt so and so, or I can't possibly do this because somebody else would disagree with me. And different personalities respond to this in different ways. Now, if you are somebody who goes, do you know what, this is my story, I'm telling it, that's going to be less of a problem. But if you are somebody who doesn't quite have that circuitry in the same way, then doing the conscious process of, okay, what are my blocks? And can I just notice myself when those come along and do it anyway? I was using Model Son to talk about, if the father were writing the story between them, is it going to be identical? No, it's not. Well, unless, I don't know. But we're going to go with the possibility that no, it's not. The father's going to see it completely differently. Does that make that story any less true? No. In fact, in a way, it shows quite how true that story is, because it is that lack of empathy or of connection to another person that
Absolutely.
creates that problem. So that's sort of where I'm thinking personal stories. Is that something you ever struggled with, or was it more a case of I can tell my story, or?
It's brilliant that you should have identified Model Son, because I was only thinking about it the other day, and I've written something. I was so obviously angry about my relationship with my father that maybe had I been a painter, I would have painted a room red from the inside, you know. But what I did, and I felt not inauthentic or dishonest, but very, very close to it, is, and I say it in the article, that however tortured these feelings were, I made sure I wrote three choruses, three verses, a chorus, and a middle eight, you know.
Exactly.
So you draw on your own experience and your own observations. I said, but maybe there's a cut-off limit, you know, maybe there's a point at which you don't expose, self-expose, you know. And I played the Model Son, and I just got this enormous round of applause at the end of it. I'm only playing the record. I showed them the lyric. But they I think what they were applaud well, somebody said they were applauding the sliding bass line as well, who knows? But you know, what's the fact that ultimately you know that song's honest, you know? And I said to them, I said in that lyric, I said, look, I got onto that middle eight, and you know, so we've danced it down the decades, mother, father, son, and
Son and
squaw. And I
squaw.
said, I was in a feminist organization, and one of the things about Big Flame was it was led by feminists in many ways. And I said, I had to, you know, I had restless nights about whether I could use that term or not, because it's so disparaging. But in the end, it seemed to be completely right. See if you can see this. I write on my walls. I'm not crazy. It's just that
Wow.
I use these plastic sheets. Here we go. Show you. I use these things.
Wow.
So it's a roll of plastic sheets which take whiteboard markers. I have to see my ideas, right? So I put them on the wall and then I write. And I've written down here, right, it says there, it says Beatles Dickie Henderson. And then it says, can you see that? I'm
Yeah.
trying, right?
Yeah.
It says novelty versus substance. Substance is not the right word. I forgot as I was thinking about this. Masculinity managed by suppression and caricature. Management of masculinity by humor. And you could see how much they were kind of suppressing their need to be, you know, recognized, celebrated as men, as these kind of, you know, these Rat Pack figures. And Dickie Henderson was the person who followed the Beatles on stage at the Royal Command performance. When John Lennon says, you know, and those of you know,
Rattle your
cheap
jewelry.
please, rattle your jewelry, right? Dickie Henderson comes on and he makes this comment, and I can't remember it verbatim, but I've cut and pasted it, which is a bit, and he says, frightening. That was frightening. And he meant it, because he knew his time was over, right? The Beatles are a completely new approach to masculinity. You've got long hair, you can admit weakness, you're not tough, you're not going to fight anybody. You sing like girls, but one of the strengths of the Beatles is that, three-part harmony. They weren't afraid, they were copying girl group songs, say, covering them, Baby It's You and, Please Mr. Postman and whatever else. And that style of masculinity almost, began to vanish overnight. Well, my father was heavily invested in that. And then I realized that he loved Billy Dainty doing this, and he used to call it funny marching. And then it dawned on me that all those generations up to mine as males would have been in the army or the armed forces. They were, not only was there national service, because of the empire, Britain was fighting wars continuously for 200 years. And if you were working class, you'd end up, you were cannon fodder. And people kind of accepted, it was internalized. It's not that the Beatles knew they were representing that, but I experienced a change in masculinity, right? And one of the reasons I had such tension with my father was that all my father did, all he wanted me to do was fight or be able to fight from the earliest. When I was 2 years old, he'd be forming my hands into fists and telling me, and how to stand and, because he was into boxing and so on. And all it meant to me was that I feared everybody outside my front door, because the message coming from my father was, you step outside there, somebody's gonna, kick your head in. So you've got to be ready for them. I mean, what a message to send to a kid.
You're essentially, you're describing trauma cycles, aren't you? That
I
it's
guess so.
social, that we pass on what we think are survival mechanisms, when really it's the survival mechanisms that causes the problem, as indeed was the
Absolutely.
truth of empire. We were causing the problems. You mentioned that sort of internal battle around the word squaw from a writing point of view, and I think this, and I'm increasingly sure this is at some level everybody, that there is some level of internal struggle about it's my story and my job is to tell my story as authentically as I am capable of doing, but at the same time there are levels of self-censoring. So what was your process of sort of saying to yourself, what am I trying to say?
I've tried to think about this. I've never tried to write about it, so I haven't r really kind of, ex identified all of the moving parts. But ultimately, I would say all the songs I wrote came from a single observation. And what happens is that they are densely packed, and what I tried to do would be to open them up. And sometimes you'd open them up and they would just fall away. It was insufficient content. And sometimes they'd open up and they'd tell you what they were. Thank you very much. This is what you need to write now. And sometimes you'd open up and think, oh my God, I mean, it's such a good idea, but where do I go? So some things kind of happened comparatively quickly. And other things took a long time. I mean, I've got some examples of songs that took 2 or 3 years to finish, song lyrics, and then they were songs because I sang them to melodies in my own head. That's how I structured them. But and some that I this thing comes and I immediately start. But one of my aunties once, when she worked in the post office at the end of the 1940s. One of the, phenomena of the Second World War here was that young British girls married American servicemen and went off to the USA. Can you imagine how excited the USA would have appeared, because they'd only seen it in the movies. I mean, I got a lot of this from my mother. She was a big movie fan. And so this young woman came into the post office, and my auntie's behind the counter. She'd only been away 6 months, and she had an American accent, and she came, and then she's from South Wales, and she comes up to my auntie and says, hey honey, give me an airmail sticker, right? It's like, what are you saying? No, give me an airmail sticker. So when my auntie told me this story, I wrote, hey mister, give me an airmail sticker. That's a lot of water to cross, but they tell me blood is thicker. All that the movie spilled supposed to make us thrill. Her face betrayed no trace of pain, no flicker. I just wrote it in what, I just wrote it in one block. So that became a song called Across the Atlantic. And then I'm from that first verse, I had to keep it going, which was basically that that way of life is an illusion, you know, but the illusion is so strongly reinforced by the images that entertain us, that we are, you know, we are led to value. That's where that came from. So I think they all came from individual observations, turns of phrase, particular. I mean, one of my, it might have been the same auntie actually, because I used to talk to her on the phone, and she'd been speaking to my auntie Cora. My auntie Cora had said
Is
that there
that
was
the
snow in the
Cora?
wind.
Is that the Cora? Yeah.
There was snow in the wind. So I wrote, "It's a snow wind." She's felt it blow, you know, and I wrote that really consistently. It didn't write itself. Nothing writes itself. That's a, you know, misleading turn of phrase. But the emotional power of it. I mean, I wrote about my grandmother's life. It wasn't my auntie Cora. My auntie Cora was younger than my own grandmother, and I knew my grandmother's life because, you know, the only reason I'm here is because my father made my mother pregnant when she was 20 or something, when they went, so they had to get married, and therefore we had to live with my grandmother because, you know, they didn't have anything to,
So,
anywhere to live.
the facts of the life were grandmother and the name was aunt and blended.
Well, this is a terrible thing. One time I was doing a songwriting class, and I was talking about Cora, and I said, and there were older people in the room, they weren't, you know, and I said, "Well, the reason I use Cora is partly because it came from my auntie Cora," and I said, "Also, but also because my grandmother's name was Gertrude, and it's not really good for a pop song." And this woman said, "But my name is Gertrude." It was like, "Oh
But
God."
it's there are artistic truths and then there are literal truths, and quite often the emotional truth is a lot more used to people than the literal truth. And you're absolutely right. Gertrude and the Snow Wind suddenly sounds like a fart joke, whereas Cora and the Snow Wind lifts and becomes a sort of human condition. You don't get that with the name Gertrude, and that's no fault of any Gertrude. It's just a
No. And it also shows that you know, in terms of what authenticity or being true to yourself, then there are lines in the road, you know, and you know, the form actually needs some kind of, you know, massaging in order for it to deliver what you are trying to deliver through it, you know.
Something that I don't know why I think this, and therefore was probably something that Richard said to my mum 25 years ago that may or may not be true, because that is where I got most of my information from, was that Donovan's Doorway was a novel or a novel in progress, or is that no?
No.
What was going on there?
I had a huge row with my partner. I stormed out of the flat, and I didn't live very far away from Anfield, you know, where Liverpool play. Liverpool were playing York City in the League Cup. I remember it really vividly. I'm really pissed off. I'm stalking along. It's February, so it's already dark. It's cold. It's miserable. Police in Liverpool, in those days, you used to see police far more visibly than you do now. They obviously used to be in twos because Liverpool was a very violent city, and everybody from sergeants upwards carried horse batons. So one of the things about, you know, about British police was they carried truncheons. They weren't, you know, the only arm they had. They didn't have guns, and you never saw them. But in Liverpool, you saw these big sticks. It was like, "I've got a big stick." You know, I mean, it's a different city from anywhere else. You didn't even see that in London. So there's a policeman in a doorway, you know, with his kind of like his stick behind him. You know, they had various positions to hold them, and there's a horrible billboard, and on the billboard there's a heart with Mick and Caroline written on it, and you know, the images that are announcing themselves as I'm walking down the street. So I watched the match, and came back and started writing all those things down, and they just organized themselves into a lyric, you know.
And was Mick and Caroline was actually written?
Actually written on a billboard that I passed. Two hearts entwined,
Oh.
Mick and Caroline, on a poster that says, "Help the poor." It might have been a charity poster, might have been an Oxfam poster, and there it was. And there was something so perfect about it, because let's say, maybe I'm embroidering this, but let's say it was an Action for Children or Action Aid poster, and yet you hear two young people declaring their love for each other on it. So actually, you know, taking over the site. I don't know. I think it was that, such a powerful connection. And then to my right, here's the state. Here's a figure of authority, and you know they've got authority because they've got a big stick in their hand. You know, so if you step out of line, I'm going to hit you with this.
Gosh.
And it was that. I suppose that's what it was. Here are people in the world who haven't got anything, and we need to support them. Here are young people trying to, embrace life and live life and see its possibilities. And there's somebody over there who's telling you what the limits are. Here are the limits to this. It was just a vignette. And I was pissed off. And I thought, well, I didn't think consciously, but I must have felt, I can feel it inside. It's like, here's a summary of why I'm pissed off. Life doesn't actually, to realize its promise. My God, it's complex.
And that relationship with anger is so important because where it can be fuel, what you're describing is seeing that change needs to be made and expressing it. Ironically, the opposite of what Empire would have told you to do, stiff upper lip and shut up, that's masculinity. But what I was thinking was the opposite reaction to that, which I'm sorry to say does often get really gendered in the people that I speak to, is the idea that anger is something that is unseemly and you have to control and makes you sound ungrateful and all of that nonsense. And I think with a lot of the writers that I'm speaking to, getting around that is a huge deal, to be able to access that anger and use it as fuel for creativity for change.
If you call it energy, very often I don't like to sanitize things or to create buzzwords, but it is an energy. What's that PIL song, John Lydon? Anger is an energy. If you think of it as an energy, and don't let it become, the cul-de-sac that anger is, because anger is an absolute cul-de-sac. No, nobody wins, do they? People just get hurt. So if people can tap what flows inside them without allowing that flow to take a negative form, if you can maintain that balance, then that's maybe when you produce,
I speak to a lot of people who my feelings have every right to be able to express what their experience with their parents or their family or their situation of lovers, whatever, one kind or another, that storyline, if you will, is in there. But they are so attuned to the reasons why they think they don't have or they feel like they shouldn't have a right to say it. What would you say to people who are finding it difficult to use the material they have?
But the point is, I haven't done it. I've written enormous numbers of songs, but the headspace I occupied while I did that was an illusory one. I wanted there to be progressive social change, which I thought was coming, because Marx says it's going to happen, and it doesn't. So I'm not putting myself down, but I know that they were illusory. So in my remaining time, there are two ways in which I want to go, two forms in which I want to express myself. One, I think I really need to settle my score with philosophy. So part of me wants to do that, and this part of me thinks I should write poetry. And I feel absolutely unable to write poetry. I don't think I'm clever enough. I don't think I'm intelligent enough. I don't think I process things clearly enough to do it. I was listening to some Seamus Heaney a few nights ago, right? I got the first, there are three volumes. I was lying there thinking, I'm not as clever as this guy. I'll never be able to do this. And if I start writing poetry, people are just going to think I'm crap, and then I'm going to have to internalize that, and I'm going to feel terrible, and I haven't got many years left. You know what I mean? So I'm not as brave as maybe you think I am, or as clear as maybe you think I am about what I do.
Or just as a devil's advocate, there are people out there, let us say, who have written poetry, but as I was experiencing, look at songwriting, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. That's a whole other thing. Because there is a wheel that we're all standing somewhere on, not just in writing, but in everything. And we're doing, oh, well, this is just me. I've done this for years. But what that person's doing over there, that's real, art. And the only way that that changes, and it's sort of me answering my own question in a way, I suppose, but the only way the fear of or the the way you look at something changes is by walking into it, doing it and going, oh, look, I'm still me and the world is still the world. And
No, I hear
know,
that.
And I just, I so hope you do it, because I would look at something like the way that you write and how the entire personality and world is just so confidently realized and everything feels so absolutely real that even when I read back lyrics and I think, actually, I felt like I understood that for years and I've just realized I didn't, because I've walked into the world and I have the confidence in the world. And it's the same with prose. You can do that when somebody knows what they're doing. And there is absolutely no way on earth that you couldn't do poetry if you decided that you were stepping through that door.
Well, yeah. And the thing is, I know that, you know, now I've made this decision, I will retire. And part of me has kind of already begun to prepare myself for stepping through that door. There's a woman on the staff here in English who was a professor of poetry, and she invited me to one of her classes, and I took the class through Blameless. Do you know the song Blameless?
Yes. Yeah. Inside Out. Yes.
Yeah. and I really like Blameless, you know, because and oddly enough, Steve doesn't like singing it. Isn't that bizarre?
Why? Which I know is not the point right now, but now I just have to ask why.
Yeah, well, he hasn't explained it, but for some reason he doesn't like it. I don't know why. And I really do.
He's wrong. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think he's wrong as well.
He's wrong.
So what I did was I took them through the writing of Blameless. And that came from, it's just a single observation, you know, as before. And I was with my then partner, and we were in her parents' house, and there was this terrible thing on the television with poor Mae West. She was like 95 at this point, and they get her to walk down a stairway and her hair is blonde, and you know, she's in this kind of tight-fitting ball gown, and it was just like, come on, she doesn't have to pretend she's 25, give her a break, you know. So undignified. Isn't there another way of celebrating her, you know?
Name to be renamed. I mean I knew that song years before I changed my name. Years before the events that caused me to change my surname occurred. But it's their ideas in the world, and it gives it is a description of a person. And actually, when I think my mum talked to me about that song when I first heard them, I think she got the wrong actress, because I think she told me it was somebody else. But so at some level,
there's a confusion in there about actresses. But I do something naughty at the end, which I've always regretted.
We're not in Kansas anymore.
It was all about Judy Garland. But Over Your Shoulder Goes One Kid, That Could Have Been You, a song, is actually a reference to a British actress from the 1930s.
So again, it's the emotional truth over the literal truth. It's something that you at some level have spotted or experienced in the world, possibly around actresses, possibly around loads of people, and it's expressing that. So the tangent that I went right away from there was you said that maybe you weren't as brave as I thought you were, and I would argue it isn't that. I'd argue that we all have areas where, for whatever reason, they're more accessible, but it remains terrifying to walk through that door. So when I've got some person that I'm talking to who's saying, oh, I can't, or thinking, I can't possibly write about my mother, father, this thing, that thing, you know, you were able to do that, but then there are other things that are that scary. So I guess as writers, it's finding out which blocks we're sitting with, and just becoming conscious of that. You know, I talk about bird spotting, that, you know, if I see a robin go past the window, I don't go, what does that say about me? I just go, oh, it's a robin. So if I see a block of me, it's like, oh, interesting information, data, give it a comfortable seat, get on with what I'm doing, because, you know, it's those blocks, they're going to be there. What's clear here is that objectively, it's no less brilliant what you do just because you look at what somebody else does and goes, that's brilliant too. You know, yeah, it possibly is, but that's not a reason not to walk through that door. When I wrote a book on creative writing, one of the central things in that was trying to be, to abandon, is this interesting, and go for, am I interested, and get yourself through that, because that is how to stay authentic, rather than, oh my God, the audience that doesn't exist yet might not like this thing that doesn't exist yet, and just paralyze yourself.
No, that's really well put. That's really well put. I do take that. There'll be one line in T.S. Eliot, or one line in Seamus Heaney, and I think, oh my God, how big is that? How much weight is there in that? Let alone the thing as a whole. And
Just as long as that doesn't make you then go, it's all or nothing. That for
I
every
know.
T.S. Eliot, there's also you. You know, that does not devalue T.S. Eliot being T.S. Eliot does not devalue you being you. And it's so important to remember that we all stand in this enormous circle looking at each other going, wow, that's amazing. You know, it's and you have to trust that what you see there, I see in things you've done and that everybody sees. You know, you have to trust that process.
But it's interesting, it's a very, very interesting conversation for me because it's about me. The point is, when I did all that writing, I mean, I wrote for a very long time. I mean, there are songs that are not Latin Quarter songs, because the point is, that it's that point of hope. I don't even remember now whose quote it was, but there should always be hope in what you write. There's always got to be a point at which, you empower people.
Absolutely. Thank you so
Okay.
much.
Take care. Lovely to meet you. We'll
Take
see you
care.
again next week. Yeah.
Really lovely to
Cheers.
meet you. Today's memoir exercise takes inspiration from how Mike mixed different real characters, different feelings he had about real characters in the song Blameless. We talked about how it was different actresses. I'd like you to mix people that represent something for you in your life. One of mine in my book that has not been announced yet but will be soon puts three mentor teacher figures together in one character, and none of them, I'd say, are more the inspiration for that person than any other, but none of them are absent from it, even if only I ever know it. So that's what I want you to do. I want you to write a character who mixes freely from your memory, your imagination, your observations and questions about your world. I'd like that character to inspire a short story. Maybe you're in their head, maybe you're looking at them from across the road. Have fun, because that's how we finish a draft. To visit the Writers' Gym in real time, visit rachelknightley.com.